Okay, so we're on chapter 11, and I think we stopped at verse 12. I have these papers all over the place, and I was just getting prepared to spend my last 30 minutes thinking about how we're going to introduce this, and of course, then I'm 10 minutes late. So here we go. I won't need this now, that's for sure. I don't have time for that one. Okay, so I thought what we would do is we would look at some verses that make a real big difference on how you interpret them from a Jewish or a Christian perspective. But the first thing I want to do is talk to you about a communication I had with Uriel ben Mordecai over the issue of jealous versus envious. You remember that we talked about the last time that we were together, we talked about the fact that I think that the word jealous is the appropriate word, and Uriel ben Mordecai uses in his translation the word envious. So I wrote to him and I said, the Greek word is the word for zeal. So zealous is what comes from that. And the question is whether or not the Hebrew reflects that same kind of idea. And so when you go back and look at the passage in Deuteronomy, you find that the passage in Deuteronomy contains a word that can be translated either jealous or envious, but it depends on the context. And the context, in my opinion, is that Paul says that the Messianics will make the Orthodox jealous, which means that, under the term jealousy, that the Orthodox community will view the Messianics as having something that belongs to them and is rightfully theirs, and that's what the word jealous means. The word envious, however, means that there's something that the Messianic community has that I want, but it actually belongs to the Messianic community. So I pointed that out to Uriel in a message to him, and he wrote back to me. And I think it's interesting that we should have this, that you should need this background. So I'm going to take you through the few emails that we had back and forth, because I think it one of the things that we want to be clear about, and we all have it, is our own personal bias that gets in the way. Just like all translation is basically a reflection of the translator. And so I want to read you this little communication because I think it helps clear up some of this. And it's going to show up again in another verse. Okay, so here's the deal. Here's my comment to him. In your translation of Romans 11:14, you use the term envious. I would alter this to jealous because envy means I want something that which rightfully belongs to another. But jealous means I want something that somebody else has that rightfully belongs to me. The Gentiles do not rightfully have a relationship with Yahweh. They are grafted into that rightful place which belongs to Israel. The fact that the Gentiles are enjoying the relationship should cause jealousy, not envy, because the true root is Israel, not the nations. Anyway, just a thought. So he writes back, sorry, I can't do that. Both in 11:14 and in 10:10, which is quoting Deuteronomy 32:21, where pa'ezireh lo'ah shows up, it is a verb, not an adjective, according to the P46. In Hebrew, Deuteronomy 32:21, achnim, is also a verb, a hifel causative, not in Hebrew and not in Greek should the relative term be rendered jealous or to make jealous. Rather, I will make them, B'nai Israel, anxious or bitter, passionate or envious. Jealous is rendered from another noun or adjective, not in the hifel causative form. Greek also has another simple noun for jealousy, which is not the same contract verb appearing in Romans 10:11, okay? From which the word zealot it comes. I hope that helps, he says. So the para stem of Greek and the hifel house in Hebrew are what convert these adjectives or nouns into verbs. And then I wrote back to him and I said, yeah, but aren't you using a dynamic equivalence in your translation? And wouldn't you want to recognize that in English, the term jealous and envious have different meanings? And he wrote back, dynamic equivalence does not give license to change the grammatical structure of the, or to achieve a desired translation. It just gives more room to substitute more suitable nouns, verbs, or adjectives. So here, the causative form is what generates the verb, I will cause them to be anxious or bitter or envious. Jealousy is nowhere in view, not no matter how you cut it. And here's the comment. From this flawed reasoning, the Gentiles saw themselves as making Jews jealous with their new religion. I don't know about you, but I don't buy it. And I think that the last comment reveals the bias that Uriel has toward this idea, because frankly, in my opinion, he's responding to the Christian idea that that the Gentile Christians are supposed to make the Jews jealous or envious so that they would want to become Christians. And of course, that's not what I'm arguing at all. What I'm arguing is that jealousy means that the true relationship with Israel really belongs to the Jews. It doesn't belong to the Gentiles. So there's no case in which they could be envious of it, because that would mean that it actually belongs to the Messianic Gentiles. Anyway, I thought I would share that with you because it helps me understand that even Uriel's translation of the P46 comes from his own background, his own experience, and you can see a little bit of that when he's resistant to accommodate the difference between jealousy and envy in English because of the use of the term in the Deuteronomy account from 32:21. Okay, just interesting stuff, because we had a little concept or discussion about that the last time, so I thought I'd share that with you. Okay, so that takes us back to chapter 11, verse 12. Unless somebody has a comment about that, we will continue with our discussion of chapter 11, and I think we'll easily finish it up today. Okay. So if we go to 11:12, you'll see that I've added some more things to the notes that I posted in the additional material, so I'll update that with Mark again. But I want to look at some of the translations that we have. So we'll start, as we usually do, with the English version from the NASB of 12, which I have as the following. Sorry, I got to go back to 11. Now, if the transgression of the riches of the world and their failure to be be riches for the Gentiles, how much more will the fulfillment be? Okay, so obviously Paul is contrasting the following. If the non-messianic Jewish community fails to recognize the Messiah, and that means a benefit to the Gentiles who are now ushered into the community via the Messiah, how much more benefit will it be when the Jewish community recognizes the Messiah? That's his argument, okay? And of course, Paul is addressing the Gentile audience here. Well, he's actually addressing the Jews as well, but his focus is on the Gentile audience, because he's going to go on to say, don't be arrogant because you think you were grafted in. You know, and that was God's work, not yours. And so we'll pay attention to the fact that the target audience in these verses is probably the Gentile messianic believers in the synagogue, right? So Paul's argument is that if the rebellion and punishment of Israel worked to the benefit of the nations, how much more will the fulfillment of the messianic kingdom for the Jewish nation mean to the entire population? How much greater will that be? Okay. And I want to point out now, we're going to go to 13, where he says, I'm speaking to you who are Gentiles. Inasmuch as I am apostle to the Gentiles, I magnify my ministry. And then 14. If somehow I might move to jealousy my fellow countrymen and save some of them. Okay, so two things. First, the comment with Uriel about jealousy and envy. So in my view, what this verse says is that he's saying to the Gentile audience that they need to pay attention to the fact that they have something, they have a relationship now which truly and technically belongs to Israel. And that should motivate the Jewish Orthodox community in the synagogue to recognize that something is happening in the Gentile community which they believe should belong to them, and they will then investigate, okay? Because the issue here is going to be over a closed-mindedness, okay? Now, so what I'm saying is that Paul's notion of if they, as he says in 14, if I could move them to recognize that what belongs to what the Gentiles are experiencing really belongs to them, I might in some way, and here's the important phrase, save them. Okay? So here's what happened. The Christian church took that verse to mean that Jews need to convert to Christianity, right? That's what that verse says from a Christian perspective. If I could only get them to accept Jesus as the Christ, the second person of the Trinity, the true God, then they would be saved. Okay? But now we need to understand what he means by that, right? Because in my view, he isn't talking about a salvation event. And the reason is because he's writing to this audience in Greek that's familiar with the Greek understanding of the word sozo, which is the Greek term for save. Okay? And I want to give you four different nuances of that Greek term, none of which involve the evangelical notion of conversion. And they are: one, saving. These terms first refer to salvation, that is human and divine, from serious peril. Curing from illness is another sense. Horses may save in battle. A knight may save an army from destruction. Good counsel may save ships, cities, castles, ships may be saved as well as people. Okay? So obviously, saving there isn't a religious term. It's a term about being rescued from imminent danger. Okay? The second nuance is keeping. The meaning at times may be keeping alive, pardoning, protecting, keeping from want, keeping from fire. Other uses are keeping from goods, wine, even beards, and preserving money. So again, it's completely materially oriented. The third nuance is benefiting. The idea of rescuing from peril disappears when the idea is that of keeping in good health, of benefiting, where the noun means well-being. And the final is preserving the inner being, a special nuance when the terms refer to preserving the inner being or nature. Okay? In philosophy, inner health may be the point of preservation. So, now you're writing to a Greek audience, and you say that you do everything possible and you hope that you may save some of your brothers. What does that mean? It doesn't mean, in my view, it doesn't mean the evangelical idea of rescuing you from sin, forgiving your guilt, and ushering you into the heavenly kingdom. It doesn't mean that at all. It clearly doesn't mean conversion, because in this particular period, there is no idea of a Jew converting at all. It's the Gentiles who are converting to Judaism, not the other way around. Okay? So what can Paul possibly mean? My suggestion is that he takes us in the fourth nuance. That is, he's saying that I may possibly provide them with well-being, because in his view, the messianic relationship is the core of what he means by a relationship with God. And that means he wants his Orthodox Jewish acquaintances to have the same well-being, the same inner peace and confidence that he has. It has nothing to do with a conversion experience. It has everything to do with what happens internally to the person. And of course, from Paul's perspective, the closed-mindedness of the Orthodox community toward Yeshua as the Messiah means that they're missing out on a benefit, right? Do you understand the difference? Okay. So when he says that I might, that some might be saved, I'm thinking that he means that some might find an inner peace and constitution, a relationship that's deeper and more preserving than the one that they have. And of course, for Paul, that means that they recognize the Messiah. Okay. But it doesn't mean that they don't have a relationship with God. It means that they're not benefiting from the full relationship with God that Paul wants them to have. Okay? Questions? No? 15. For if the rejection be the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? Okay, so now it looks like, if I were reading this from a Christian perspective, it would look like Paul's saying, oh my gosh, the Orthodox Jews who don't accept Jesus as the Messiah, they're dead, and they need to come back to life, right? But let's notice a few things. First, rejection, the word rejection, apobole in Greek, is the removal of someone from a particular association. It doesn't mean the complete abandonment. It means that the relationship has been interrupted, has been disrupted. Okay, and he says, and it may be necessary to indicate more specifically the participants and the implied relationship. For example, for if they are rejected meant the people in general were reconciled to God, then it would be different than saying that if they were rejected, then the reconciliation would be a form of acceptance, right? So what Paul is saying, I think, is that their rejection means that they've missed out on the next step in the benefit that God provides because they've refused to recognize that Yeshua is the Messiah. And as a result of that, the relationship is hindered. It doesn't mean the relationship is over. It means that there's some block that's occurred, and he wants that to be removed so that they will experience all the benefits that come from having a relationship with the Messiah within the Jewish community. Okay? That's not the only thing. Let's take a look at life from the dead. What does that mean? Okay? And what does he say? He said, wouldn't their acceptance be life from the dead? Okay? From a Christian perspective, of course, we consider that the theology considers that a statement of Paul that without Christ, without Jesus, they're dead. Okay. But I don't think that's what he's saying at all. In fact, I think what he's saying is, look at how Uriel translates this. 11:16. Hold on. Get there. I think what he's saying is, now, if the fourth portion is kadosh, seriously, if their deprivation means reconciliation for humanity, what shall become of the acceptance if not life from the dead? So if we see, he's saying, listen, if the Orthodox community recognizes that Yeshua is the Messiah and the Messianic age has been initiated, right, the Messiah has come, wouldn't that bring them more life, right? Wouldn't that cause them to celebrate, to have more joy, to see what God's hand has done? Wouldn't that mean that they come from a position of obedience and acceptance of Torah in the rabbinic world, but now they have the joy of recognizing the Messiah? And I think that's what he has in mind, because I don't see any way that you can read this as Paul saying that the Jews need to convert, right? That's not going to happen. It's not what Paul experienced, certainly not what the Gentiles experienced. So it can't be a contrast between death without the Messiah and life with the Messiah. It has to be an issue of the full benefits that aren't experienced, and that we get from the previous verse. Okay?
Yeah, that makes sense, Skip, because I mean that's what they've been waiting for. I mean that's what Jews had been waiting for. So I mean, imagine the joy.
How much more would they live?
And Paul is saying that's happened. So I want more than anything else for my Jewish brothers to experience this same joy of recognizing what God has done. And the fact that they're closed-minded, that they don't accept it, is the pain in my heart that says if they would only accept this, look how much fuller their life would be. Okay. Okay. So let's go to the next verse then, where he says, and if the first piece of the dough is holy, the lump also. This is the first fruits idea. And if the root be holy, the branches are also. Okay. So now, if you accept this analogy, what he's really saying is Israel has a holy relationship with God. It is the root. So, if the root is already in a holy relationship with God through the covenant, then you expect that you want the branches to experience that relationship as fully as possible, right? Now he's going to use that example. He's clearly not saying that Israel is outside of the relationship because Israel is the root. What he's going to do now in the next few verses is use that analogy to say, oh, here are some branches that have been grafted in. And those branches, which represent the Gentiles, that have been grafted into the root, right? They're experiencing something that the root provides, but other branches aren't experiencing, right? Here's the root, God's covenant relationship with Israel, okay? What's happened is the Gentiles that are coming in through the Messiah are experiencing the covenant relationship with Israel. And some of the branches that come from the same root aren't experiencing that. And what Paul says, I want those branches to experience it too. If you can see it, if you can see the blossoms and the fruit on one side of the tree, I want the other side of the tree to have the same benefit. Okay? So that's what this whole analogy is about. And if you read through the analogy with that in mind, just see what you think. Okay? So now he says,
if Israel is the root, which other branches aren't experiencing it?
The root is the covenant relationship at Sinai with Israel. The root is God's choice of Israel. Okay? So as you grow up through that root, two things happen. You have branches of the root, or three things happen. You have branches of the root who are Jews and messianic. They've accepted the Messiah, and they are experiencing the full power of the root of the covenant. Okay? You have branches of the Gentiles who've been grafted in, and they are also experiencing the full power of the root. They're experiencing the covenant relationship with God at Sinai. Okay? But then you have some branches that have, in Paul's view, have closed their minds to the possibility that Yeshua is the Messiah. They're the people who say, I'm comfortable with what I believe, and you can't provide them with the evidence necessary to show them that there's an alternative, right? Those people are still they're still part of the tree, because their origin, their foundation is the covenant relationship with Israel at Sinai. But they're not experiencing the benefit. They're not experiencing the full blossoming benefit of that part of the tree, right? So Paul's saying those branches need to look and see what's happening with these other branches that are being grafted in and that are natural, and realize that there's more to this relationship than what they have. And they see that, it makes them think, that should belong to me, jealousy, and therefore I'm going to open my mind to listen to what they're saying so that I can also experience that benefit. I think that's the argument that he has. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah, we're all branches. I wasn't sure. I was thinking the Jews were the root, but we're all branches. So, okay.
We're all branches. The root is Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Moses, right? That's the foundation for all of this. That doesn't change. And by the way, the fact that he even talks about a holy root should tell the evangelical Christian world that they've misinterpreted this analogy. Because if the root is the covenant relationship with Israel, and that doesn't change, then the covenant relationship with Israel should be the foundation of the messianic relationship with God as well, which has to include the Mosaic law, the history of God's interaction with the Jews, the relationship to Abraham. All, you can't set that aside, because you see what he's saying is, if that part is holy, then everything else that grows from it is also holy. This is the first fruits. If Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's relationship is holy with God, and they show that God has chosen these people, then everything that comes from that is also in the same, you know, has the same status. That it enjoys or doesn't enjoy the benefits is the issue, not the status. Okay? The status is chosen people of God. The question is, what benefits are you enjoying? And what Paul is saying is, the Gentiles are enjoying benefits that this closed-minded group of Jews aren't enjoying. But the Jews have the right foundation, right? Okay? So let's see how he develops the Michael. Yeah, Michael.
Yeah, so Yeshua quite often uses the same imagery about the branches, but he says that those branches that are dried up are going to be cut off and cast into the fire. Paul's
going to say the same thing. Just wait, hang on a second. We got to go a couple of verses, and you'll see that he says the same thing, okay? And then if you have a question, you ask it then, okay? So look what he says. Look at the next couple of verses, right? So the first thing that he says is to the Gentiles in 16, don't be arrogant toward the branches, right? Because after all, you got grafted in. You weren't part of the natural growth. You were added, okay? So he says, don't be arrogant. And the term is, find it now. Hold on. I have too many pieces of paper floating around here. 16. It says, don't be arrogant. And he argues, well, what do I do with it? Hold on. Oh, I don't know where I put it. Oh, sorry. Don't have the note. It's here somewhere. I just can't find it. Okay. So what he's saying is, it means to think better of yourself than you should. Okay. So if the Gentiles are saying, oh my, look, you know, I have a relationship with the God of Israel that's dynamic, that's fulfilling, it's connected to the Messiah, and you don't have that, so I'm better than you. Paul is cautioning them not to take that approach, because what he says is, your relationship with the Messiah depends on the foundation that these people have. So you have no right to act as though somehow you're in a special position. In fact, the truth of the matter is exactly the opposite. The foundation belongs to them, and you're only attached to it, right? Okay, so then he says, if you were arrogant, remember that you weren't the one who supports the root, but the root supports you. You will say then, branches are broken off that I might be grafted in, right? Here it comes. Here's Michael Stanley, right? Branches were broken off that I might be grafted in. Quite right. He says, yes, that's right. God had a plan with Israel. And in that long history, some branches were removed. Okay. It doesn't mean that the root ever changed. It means the foundation is there. But if we think of the branches as individuals, not all individuals shared, even though they were of the tribe of Israel, not all individuals shared the relationship with the covenant God of Israel. Some branches were broken off, right? So Paul says, you're right. Some branches were broken off in order for you to be grafted in, right? Then he says in 20, quite right. They were broken off for their unbelief. Now, I know that I have a note on this. I wonder if I just didn't print it. 20. Hold on, because there's an important word here. Here we go. For their unbelief. Okay. And the word is apistia. Okay. So now this is important because in Greek, the root word is pistos, which we have believe, right? And we know that that's a noun, which means to have a trusting relationship. And the negative of the noun is to add the vowel aleph, the letter aleph to the beginning of the word. So we get apistia. The negative of believing. So unbelief, this is important. Unbelief does not mean that they have a cognitive statement of faith different from the messianics. It doesn't mean that, because unbelief means that they don't have the same degree of reliability and trusting that belongs to the idea of belief. Believing is reliability and trustworthiness. So what he's saying is these people don't have the same degree of reliability and the degree of trustworthiness that the Messianic community is enjoying. In other words, it's a theocentric view, right? Hence, faith is the human reaction to God's primary action. And what he's saying is the community of Israel that came from the root, those branches that were broken off, did not respond to God's action. That's what he's saying, right? Apistia, unbelief, means the lack of human response to an action perpetrated by God. And of course, the Messiah is the paradigm case of this. God initiates the role of the Messiah. He sends the Messiah in order to speak to Israel. Remember, he says, I've come to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. It didn't go to the Gentiles. And Paul is saying, you see, those branches that were broken off, they lacked the proper response to God's initiating act. Okay? So, they didn't respond to God's act in the Messiah. This is not the same as saying that they didn't believe. Okay? This does not mean that they don't have a relationship with God. It means that they didn't accept God's anointed one, right? That's very different. than saying that they were cut off because they didn't believe. In fact, they did believe, but they didn't accept the peace that Paul's trying to argue for, and that he's been arguing for all of his life, that the Messiah has actually come. Okay, everybody understand that? It's a big difference.
But wait, but you're saying some branches actually were broken off. So who would have been broken off and not come back?
But remember, broken off is not the same as excommunicated. Okay, let's be clear about this. Okay, so what Paul, look, here's Paul's argument as far as I'm concerned. Paul says, listen, God initiated the role of the Messiah and provided Yeshua as his authorized agent. That makes a difference because God is doing something in the world that is directly related to his plan for Israel, and that includes the Gentiles. That's step number one. Step number two, you as the Orthodox Jewish community need to recognize what God is doing and respond to it. Step number three, some of you have, and Gentiles have also recognized that and come into your community through this extended relationship initiated by God. But there are you in the Orthodox community who are closed-minded and haven't been willing to entertain the evidence to show you that this is God's handiwork. Okay? You do not enjoy the full benefit of the relationship with God that is now provided through the Messiah. Right? So you're cut off from this fuller relationship. You still have a connection to Israel, because that'll never go away. God's chosen Israel forever. Okay?
No,
but you're not experiencing it all. You've left something on the table. You see it happening with the Gentile community, but you haven't taken the step to recognize what's happening, and you haven't responded to God's action in a way that gives you the full benefit, right?
No, I understand that. I understand what Paul's saying to them. What I'm saying is, in 17, where he's saying in the past, some branches were broken off and now were wild and didn't come back, and that's made it where you could be grafted in. I'm saying, who is he talking about? What Jews in the past?
Because if we go a few more verses, just hold on. If we go a few more verses, he says, don't you realize that those branches that were broken off can be grafted back in? So it wasn't like they're done forever, right? I don't know where you get remarks from. He's in the past. He says, but conditional. If some branches were broken off so that you could be grafted in, right? You still depend on the root, right? So don't be arrogant toward those branches because you depend on them, right?
Okay. So
in other words, it's a hypothetical. What he's saying is, look, you're enjoying this relationship with the Messiah. That relationship truly belongs to Israel. But God, in his mercy and graciousness, has opened the door for you to experience the same relationship. Part of Israel, some part of the Orthodox community, isn't experienced that relationship. If that means that because they're not experiencing it, you have the opportunity, then mazel tov, bless them. Because that gives you the opportunity to come in. But it's an if. He isn't saying God cast them away so that you could come in. He's saying if, in fact, the reason that you came in is because they were broken off, then you should be grateful. Right? That's different than saying God got rid of some in order to make space. In other words, it depends on whether or not you think heaven, or you think the relationship with God is a zero-sum game. There's only so many relationships available, and I want to bring one in. I got to get rid of one, right? That's not what Paul's saying. What Paul's saying is, as those new relationships were developed, you in the Orthodox community with your closed minds are missing out. And the result is you need to reevaluate, because the Gentiles will think, we came in because some of you didn't see what was happening, okay? Now, I want you to see what was happening so that you can experience the same relationship that they have.
Okay.
An even greater one.
According to Paul, the Jews that are not seeing. They're still part of Israel and still part of the relationship with God. They're just not getting the full benefit of everything.
That's right. Exactly. They're still part of Israel. They'll always be part of Israel. They still have a relationship with God through the Torah and Sinai. They just aren't experiencing the full benefit. So the Gentiles who are now experiencing the full benefit should cause the Jews to say, hey, wait a minute. Why are they getting more benefit than me? That's my relationship that they're, you know, resting on, right? And Paul's argument is, if you Gentiles think that God brought you in because some other people didn't get the whole benefit, then, you know, you should be grateful to them because that means that you had an opportunity. Okay? Does that make sense? You okay? We're good?
Yeah.
Okay. Now let's see how Uriel handles this. Okay? So we're going to read 19 and 20, 21. Okay? Because that's the important theological piece that Christians use to argue that the Jews are outside of the will of God because they don't accept the Messiah. So let's see what Uriel says. Are you going to say branches were cut off so that I could be grafted in? Notice, Uriel makes it a hypothetical as well, right? In our view, it's if you say. And what does Uriel say? Are you going to say branches were cut off? Doesn't mean that they actually were. It means that the Gentile population is thinking God had to get rid of some in order to make room for me. Okay? What is Paul's answer? Please, their refusal to trust is what got them cut off. And your commitment to trust is what maintains your status. Don't be arrogant. Be respectful. Fear instead. Because then listen to what he says. If, in fact, God was not lenient toward the branches by nature, come what may, he's not going to be lenient toward you either. You can see, then, a compassionate side of God and a harsh side. Harshness toward those who, on the one hand, will cause harm, and I'm going to issue with that. But on the other, toward you, a compassion from God, provided that you continue doing what is charitable. Otherwise, you too will be cut off. Okay? So there's two things going on here. The first argument is, Paul says, I want everybody to have the full experience. That means you recognize that God did something with the Messiah, and once you recognize that, your relationship with God is enhanced. Okay? Some people don't recognize that. They're missing out on the benefit. You who have the benefit don't think that the other people are somehow inferior to you. The very fact that you have the benefit means that God provided that benefit through them. Okay? That's the first thing. Second thing is, he's saying, okay, now that we've established that everybody's going to have their benefit on what God does, and it depends on your response to it, now let's look at, if God didn't spare those people who were naturally a part of the root, if he did not chastise them, if he didn't send them to Babylon, if he didn't deal with them over 1,000 years of their idolatry, if he was firm with them, do you think that somehow he won't be the same with you just because you got grafted in? Right? Paul's argument is not about what happened to the Jews. It's about what the Gentiles will expect as a result of being grafted into the same root, right? They should expect the same reality, okay? And then he says in 21, all right, I'm sorry, in 21, for if God didn't spare the natural branches, he did not spare you either. 22, behold then the kindness and severity of God to those who fell, okay? So this is interesting, because in Christian theology, we take those who fell to mean that they fell outside of the relationship with God. But that's not what the word means. Hold on just a second, and I will give it to you. To those who fell. It means abandoned my God in guilt. Falling is identical to guilt. Pipto is the word, and it means a loss of the trusting relationship and separation from grace, according to Christian theology. At issue here is an apostasy from God in Christ. This is according to Christian theology, right? But the actual meaning, which is used 400 times in the Septuagint, corresponds almost exclusively to a Hebrew word, nafal, which basically means, has a very wide range of meanings, and basically means to fall down. It doesn't mean to be excommunicated, right? It means to trip up, to fall down, to collapse, to, you know, to end up on your face, right? It doesn't mean that God threw you out. It means that you weren't able to stand. That's what it literally means. And the Septuagint uses it over and over and over for this Hebrew term. So the Christian idea that this means that you're out of touch with God does not follow from the Septuagint's use of the Greek word pipto for this Hebrew word nafal. Okay? So, Paul's thinking in Septuagint Greek, in Jewish Greek, then he's thinking about the word in Hebrew, and it means that you fell down. For those who fell down, right? They didn't respond properly. They missed the boat. Okay? For those who fell down, he says, I've lost the verse now. But behold the kindness and severity of God. For those who fell down, who missed the boat, severity. But for you, kindness. If you, now check the last part of this verse, because it's really important. For you, kindness. And then he says what? If you continue in what is charitable. Okay. In basically here it says, if you continue, in his kindness, okay? And Uriel translates this, provided you continue to do what is charitable. But the actual word is a word that we're very familiar with that connects us back to the law, right? In other words, the word for goodness and kindness, there's no pronoun, by the way. It doesn't say his kindness. It basically says that this word is used always as a presupposition for the law. And of course, what that means is Paul is saying is, listen, you will continue to enjoy the trusting relationship and the full benefits of connection to Israel if you do what the Mosaic Code says. Right? That's basically what he's arguing. He's not saying, oh my gosh, you just have to be a good person. Right? Because the use in the Septuagint immediately connects you to the Mosaic Code. So this is really quite really interesting, right? So think about Paul's argument. He says, listen, God sent the Messiah to give you the full benefits of the relationship with him. You accepted the Messiah. You have the full benefits. Other people who should have accepted the Messiah don't have the full benefits. But don't think that because you have the full benefits, it means you're somehow disconnected from the root. You're not. You depend on the root. And what is the root? The covenant relationship with God at Sinai. And what does that mean? The Mosaic Code. So you Gentiles who come into the Messianic community because of God's kindness are now obligated to the Messianic Code just as the original Jews were, right? If you really understand that verse from a Jewish perspective, think about what it means for the Christian church.
Yeah, it's basically saying you can't give up just because you've accepted, you know, the benefit of Yeshua and the relationship with God. You can't give up the Mosaic Code. That's part of it.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what Paul's
saying. Torah is still alive.
Yeah, what Paul's saying is this. I'm so glad that you're experiencing the benefits of the Messiah. He has initiated the way for you to get in contact with the God of Israel. But don't think that the initiation is enough. Right? The only way that that relationship continues, according to Paul, is if you adopt the Mosaic Code, if you live Torah, right? And there it is, right there in the verse. So how in the world can the Christian church think that what that means is Jews need to become Christians, right? Paul's saying exactly the opposite. Those who have converted on the basis of the Messiah must adopt the same life directions that Moses provided at Sinai. Right? Do you see that? So Uriel translates this verse 21. In fact, God was not lenient by the branches of nature. Come what may, he's not going to be lenient toward you either. And then 22, as you can see, the compassionate side of God, and then he says on the one hand, those who cause harm, and that's not what I think the word means, right? Provided that you continue doing what is charitable. But the reason that he says charitable is because the Greek term is charisis, right? Which is charity, okay? But the fact of the matter is the Hebrew concept behind that is goodness and kindness, and that's related in the Septuagint directly to the Mosaic Law. So what I think Paul is saying is, Listen, if you want to maintain the relationship, you got to maintain the Torah, period. Right? Otherwise, you will think that you've been initiated because of the benefits of the Messiah, but the relationship, the continuing relationship, depends on Torah. Michael Stanley, you had something to say?
Yeah, so going back to my question about, you know, always saying that, you know, the Jews will be able to be grafted back in, whereas Yeshua says, no, they're cast into the fire. So okay, my question is, does Yeshua mean...
But wait, Paul doesn't say the Jews will be able to be grafted in. He's talking about those Jews whose closed-mindedness doesn't allow them to accept the fact that Yeshua is the Messianic Messiah. There is the Jewish Messiah, right? He's not talking about all Jews. He's talking about those Jews who are closed-minded to the evidence that he wants to bring about the Messiah. So we clarified that, okay? Now we can go to the Yeshua question. Doesn't Yeshua say the same thing? He's talking about the vine and the branches, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so in that parable of the vine and the branches, not all of the branches are cut off. Not all of the vines are destroyed. Not everything goes into the fire. Just those ones who refuse to accept the evidence of the relationship that God has initiated through the Messiah, right?
Okay.
So isn't Paul saying the same things? He's saying it as a hypothetical, by the way. He's not saying, okay, all the Jews who are closed-minded, they're going to hell. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, if there are any, then God would treat them severely, like he has in the past, right? And it doesn't mean God, and remember, severe doesn't mean excommunicated, right? It means that God will continue to put pressure so that they will recognize the truth of the Messiah. That's what I think Paul's argument is. Now, does that mean that Yeshua meant when he said that the branches were cut off and cast into the fire? The context is, what was he trying to get across to the audience? Was he trying to get across the idea that everyone who doesn't accept him is going to go to hell? Or is he trying to say something about how important this decision is and how open-minded you have to be to the evidence that, you know, that he is the chosen one of God? Right? I'd have to go back to the Gospels and look at that account to see what the context is. But all I have right now is Paul in front of me. And Paul is saying, hypothetically, if there are people in the Jewish community that are not open-minded, God is going to work on them because he's God severe, right? God's going to work on them to bring them around to see the full benefits that they're seeing on display in the Gentiles in the same community. Okay, does that help?
Yeah, and so could I then maybe take Yeshua's statement about casting into the fire not as ultimate destruction, but as a purging? In other words, like he purged the people going to Babylon. He didn't destroy them. Right.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, because the imagery, you know, we want to take the imagery as absolutes. Oh my gosh, they're cast in the fire, they're destroyed. Of course, that doesn't fit our idea of hell either. But nevertheless, I think you're right that what he's pointing out is how critical the decision is and how consequential the refusal to accept him as the Messiah is, right? That life is going to be really difficult, right? But it doesn't mean that they're destroyed. Right? Because it's like Paul saying, okay, so you can see two things in the history of the Jews. You can see God's severity and you can see his compassion. I mean, think about what it says in Isaiah 40, Nachmu, Nachmu, right? Comfort you, comfort me, my people. Because I've taken you through all this stuff and you paid double for all of your sins, but I never let you go. Okay? So obviously God is severe about those people who don't follow his instructions, right? And what Paul's trying to point out is how important it is for the Gentiles to realize that that's the character of God. That he isn't just the all-compassionate Father, oh, it's so nice of you to join the party. That there are consequences for all of this. Yeah, Larry and Phyllis.
So how do you think God reconciles himself to the fact that the Christian church has actually pushed the Jews farther away from Yeshua.
I think that's one of the great, one of the greatest sins that the world has ever seen. That Christianity, because of its connection with Greek philosophy, chose to separate itself from its own historical root, right? And created a new religion. And the way that they created the new religion was to make it different than the religion that Paul's talking about, because Paul's talking about Judaism and the Gentiles coming into a connection with the God of Israel. But the Christian church altered all that for their own purposes, and as a result, they were forced to deny that God had anything to do with the Jews. Look, it's about manifest destiny, okay? The Christian church believes that their manifest destiny is to convert the entire world to Christianity. So they can't have a religion that's connected to the same God, that's competitive with them, that also has a legitimate claim. They have to make that claim illegitimate in order to argue that they're the only true church, right? And they did that by becoming anti-Semitic. So they, so Christianity reads this letter from Paul as an anti-Semitic letter, that Paul's saying that if you don't become a Christian, you're, you know, God will get rid of you.
Also, to change how Yeshua is perceived totally. I mean,
absolutely,
how he's seen as an individual.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. But, and we recognize
why,
that.
But that's the point why the
here,
rabbis.
Paul, here's the point. The point is that Paul isn't saying that. The Christian church interpreting Paul according to their own agenda makes him say that. But if you read Paul in his Jewish-Greek Septuagint thinking, you will recognize that that's not what he's saying. And in fact, he goes overboard in this verse alone to say that the only reason that you maintain that relationship that's so vital for the Gentiles is because you follow the Mosaic Code, which, of course, the church completely denied. Right.
But that's why the rabbis teach Paul changed everything. They blame it. You know, they don't. I mean, I've been in many rabbis, and they, you know, I have a rabbi that said, you know, we had a whole discussion, and somebody said, what would you do if Jesus came in today? You know, what would you? And he said he'd put his kippah would be on, his tallit would be on. He'd pick up the Tanakh wherever we were, the siddur, and keep going. It's Paul. That's,
yeah.
It's not one rabbi I've heard him say this.
No. It's look,
multiple.
Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi of Great Britain, right? He said the same thing.
Most
of the rabbis that I know would have no problem with Jesus.
Right.
Because,
and even
I was just reading something the other day, which basically says that, I know, it's this classic, I finally got it. It's this classic book, Jesus of Nazareth by Klausner. The same guy who wrote the Messianic idea and from Genesis to the end of the Talmudic period, right? It was written a long time ago, but and by the way, it was written in Hebrew, which is why it wasn't widely read in the Christian world, right? So now it's translated. I'm reading this text, and basically what he's saying is everything about Jesus is Jewish, right? He said the guy's the perfect example of a Pharisaic thinking Jewish sage in the first century. The problem is Paul, right? And the reason that the problem is Paul is because of the church, because the church took Paul and made him literally the theological father of Christianity, not Jesus, right? And of course, though, that put the split between Paul and Jesus, which has been a theological debate for centuries, right? Because even very intelligent guys like Jonathan Sacks read Paul from the perspective of the church instead of doing what we're doing, looking at it and saying, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. If Paul is really a Christian, why would he say that if you're going to maintain your relationship to Jesus, you have to follow the Mosaic Code? That doesn't make any sense at all, right? So the church decides that Paul couldn't have meant that. He meant something else, when in fact, what we're really saying is that's what Paul wrote. Right.
Yeah, that's why Uriel spent all that time trying to retranslate the from the book that you're reading, because he wanted to represent Shaul or Paul in the way that Shaul would want to be represented.
Yes.
I want to go go ahead.
Yeah. And I recognize that. My problem is that sometimes Uriel gets into defense of Judaism as opposed to, in opposition to Christianity, as opposed to, okay, what do the words actually say, right? Like the issue over jealousy and envy, right? And there's another one that's coming up where he uses body and soul, which I would never use because it's not a Hebrew idea. But that's only because he's also very concerned about it. Paul being read as a Christian instead of being read as a Jew.
Yeah. Right. Well, and if I can, I'll throw this in real quick. We did some study with Uriel. What my perception of Uriel is, first of all, he's born Jewish, but he was raised Christian and followed Christianity for a while before he came to this realization. And now he has this, he almost has this thing where he feels like he has to fight for the Jews because he made a mistake by not following them. And he gets really angry and aggressive when he attacks people. But at any rate, I just want to comment on verse 22 real quickly. And that is, you know, NSB translates the word kindness and Uriel translates the word charitable. I almost wonder if Shaul is thinking of the word hesed when he talks about that. I just want to know what your thought was about that.
I don't think he's thinking chesed because I think he's thinking in the use of the way that it happens in the Septuagint. And in the Septuagint, the word isn't chesed. The word is a word for kindness that is the Greek expression that's directly connected to the Torah.
Oh, right? Okay.
So in the Septuagint, you can't divorce kindness, the kindness of God from the Torah. That's different than chesed. Chesed is a much broader term. And by the way, we're going to run into chesed if we keep going, because that word is actually going to come up in terms of another Greek term that Paul uses, right? But in this verse, I think it's just that we ought to translate that verse that says, if you continue in Torah obedience, that would be the way that Paul would think about it.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's see if we can do a couple more verses because I was late. So let's look at 23. And they also, if they do not continue in their unbelief, will be grafted into God. Okay, so here's the same thing. Remember, unbelief does not mean a rejection of the faith. Unbelief means a lack of trust in the evidence that's presented. What's the right term? It's the word that we've been using already. It's the idea of considering the evidence that Paul presents as unreliable. Okay. So he's not saying, so here's what he's saying in this verse. If they continue in that way, if they continue to refuse the evidence that I'm presenting about the Messiah, then what's going to happen? If they can't be grafted back into the Messianic community, if they're refusing to accept this God-initiated event, but if they do accept it, then what happens? Then they experience the full benefit, just like the Gentiles are, because they're already Torah observant, so now they just get the next layer added on, right? Okay? So then he says in 24.
It's almost as if Paul saw the split coming between the Orthodox Jews and the Messianic community. It's almost as if
But of course he saw that coming because remember, the Romans is the last letter. He'd already been fighting this battle for 25 years, right? He'd already been going from synagogue to synagogue, trying to teach in the synagogue, the Orthodox community, the evidence of Yeshua as the Messiah. And of course, he had a mixed reception. In some places they accepted it, in some places they didn't, right? And all along he's seeing Gentiles who are coming into the community, experiencing the benefit. So by the time he gets to the Roman letter to the Romans, he's saying, look, for 25 years I've been working on this, and I can tell you this is what's going to happen. Some people will be closed-minded and they won't accept the evidence that I'm going to present. Those closed-minded people will still see Gentiles coming into the community and experiencing the joy, the peace, the fullness of a relationship with God. And they won't be able to explain that because, after all, the relationship should be theirs, but now it's being exhibited by the Gentiles. So what's the problem? Their close-mindedness. That's the problem. And if they open their minds and recognize what's happening with Yeshua, they'll experience the benefit too.
But he would never have seen the split that actually did happen, I don't think. No, I don't think he ever would have seen that.
Yeah, because Paul, look, the urgency on Paul is that you gotta make a choice now because Yeshua is coming back and then everything will be settled, right? So Paul never expected 2,000 years later that we'd have these massive distinctions, you know, going on, because nobody in the first century, nobody even thought you'd have a Trinitarian God. I mean, nobody, right? Not even the church fathers. Okay. So let's go a few more verses. Okay. 23. And they also, if they do not continue in their unbelief, will be grafted back in. Okay. God's able to bring them back. 4. If you were cut off from what is by nature a wild olive tree and were grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, how much more shall those who are of the natural branches be grafted in? All he's doing is saying, wouldn't it be great if the experience, if the people who already have this deep experience and history with God understood who Yeshua is as the Jewish Messiah? Just think of the benefit that they would have. That's all he's basically saying. He's using that analogy to sort of create this awareness of what happens with the benefits of the Messiah. Okay? So now we get to 25. For I do not want you, brethren, to be uninformed about this mystery. What's the mystery? The mystery is God is doing something different. Mystery, by the way, doesn't mean something that you never can figure out. The word mysterion in Greek means something that was hidden, that's now revealed. It's something hidden, okay? So what was hidden? That Yeshua was going to show up as the Messiah. God, you know, look, even the guys who are walking on the road to Emmaus who had all the, you know, Tanakh with it, right, in their heads, they didn't see it. So it was revealed, right? This mystery was revealed. And what he says is, I don't want you to miss the point that when God revealed all of this stuff, right? I don't want you to miss that, lest you be wise in your own estimation. In other words, if you think you know all the answers, then you won't be open to the possibility that God's going to do something different, right? He's going to do something new. Okay. And he says, lest you be wise in your own estimation, that a partial hardening. Now this is wonderful because this is the verse that Christians used to say that God pulled a veil over the Jews' eyes so that they couldn't see the Messiah in order to keep them in the dark until eventually at the end they'll all become Christians, okay? So we need to understand what the word partial hardening means, okay? So I just happen to do some notes on that if I can find them. Right, okay, so here it is. Partial is the word manos, it just means small, okay? So partial hardening. Uriel treats this as a state of porousness, but I don't think that's exactly right, because I think the real word, which comes from, it does come from a word, poru, right? It means having a closed mind. So what Paul is saying is, if you have a partially closed mind, you will not be able to recognize this now revealed, but once hidden fact that Yeshua as the Messiah was a God-initiated event, right? Paul uses the terminology as a way to heighten the Greeks' expectation that there's something really important happening here that I couldn't see before, right? But now I can see it. Now it's been revealed. Only those people, and by the way, partial hardening, a partially closed mind, what does that mean? It doesn't mean that they're closed off to everything. It means that only some parts of God's revealed truth are not, they are not open to. And what are those parts? Well, certainly not the relationship in Sinai, not the history of Judaism, not the interpretation of Scripture. It's only the pieces that say, oh, look, here, the Jewish Messiah has arrived. That's the piece that they don't see. They're closed-minded in that one area. All the rest of it, they're working fine. Okay? So he says, if they have this closed mind, right? Until the fulfillment of the Gentiles has come in. So what does that mean? Well, the church interpreted that as until all the Gentiles are saved. But that isn't necessarily what Paul means at all. What he's saying is, until the Gentiles recognize that Yeshua is the Messiah, when that event occurs, then at whatever, when in whatever community it happens in, and remember he's thinking the Messianic or the Jewish Orthodox Messianic communities, whenever that happens, what do the people with a partially closed mind see? They see exactly what he wants them to. The Gentile population experiencing a deep and fulfilling relationship with God, which he hopes will break through that closed-mindedness and cause them to reevaluate, right? And in order to show that's the case, he gives you some citations from the Tanakh, that all Israel will be saved, remember? So the church reads that as all Israel will be converted. But that doesn't what it means. It means all Israel will receive the full benefits of what God is doing. Okay? You can think of that as all Israel will experience all well-being. Okay? Just as it is written, and then he gives you these citations from the Tanakh to show that his evaluation is backed up by the prophets. Okay? Now, who is going to read that and appreciate the fact that he's citing from the prophets? The Gentile community? No. The Gentile community doesn't have a deep relationship with the prophets. The reason Paul's citing the Tanakh is because he wants the closed-minded people who are in the synagogue who are now going to read his letter to realize that's what the prophets are saying. Oh, I better open my mind to this idea. So he cites an authority in their world to show them that they need to reevaluate. Do you understand? Okay.
Yep. I was just, if you go back to the verse 24 when, and it says a wild, if you were wild and you were grafted, somehow, once I think I had read something about, it's not a natural thing to take an unnatural branch and try and graft it to a tree and hope that it's going to survive. So it's a drastic thing that God is doing. And it's like he's trying to show how unreasonable in the sense of nature, everyday's agricultural practices, and yet God was able to do it. So imagine what he can do with Israel. It was
an excellent point. That in fact, in horticulture, you can't take a branch from a tree of a different species, basically, and graft it in. It just doesn't attach. It doesn't grow, right? But what he's saying is, God took this branch that wasn't connected at all and made it happen. Okay? And that is only to show how mysterious this whole thing is. How is it possible that God could do that? Here's all the nations of the world who weren't involved in Sinai, didn't have a covenant commitment with God, didn't have a relationship with him, and were often hostile to Israel. How is it that God could open a way for them to be crafted into Israel? That's a mystery. And now Paul's saying that's been revealed. It's not hidden anymore. So you Orthodox, go back to your prophets, look at these verses, and realize this is what God is doing. Okay. Lindy, get the final comment.
Well, I apologize because I walked away, but we learned when we were in Israel once that in order to revive an olive tree that was dying, they actually grafted in a wild olive branch. Do you remember that? Did you hear that?
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. So it's, give it new life.
I'm sorry?
It gives it new life then, huh?
Yep. So if you take that analogy and you take this analogy, it's just a good connection.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to stop. I will be on time tomorrow. No, wait a minute. Do we change? I think we changed time zones in Italy tomorrow. I'm not sure. I'll have to look. But anyway, I will be on time at 8 o'clock Eastern time, no matter what time it is here in Italy. And we'll continue. And I know that we'll finish 11 and maybe get into 12 a little bit tomorrow. Okay.
Shabbat shalom, everybody.
I'll see you tomorrow, 8 o'clock Eastern time, USA.
Shabbat shalom.